This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. My name is Hugh, I am the host of the show, and I'd just like to take this opportunity to put in a really mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on the show are reserved just because the thing that we're talking about is in some way not good. However, sometimes we're talking about aspects of art or artists that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode description for more details, and do be aware of your listening environment. This evening, I have the very great pleasure of welcoming back Elizabeth Little. And this time, also, we have Errol. Good evening, guys. How's Hi. It going? I suppose it's good Hello, morning for good, you guys. You.
It is. It's so early for me. I'm incredibly weak. It's 10 a.m. here.
Time zones aside, we have convened to discuss a movie. What a movie. I put a post out on Blue Sky because, very sadly, although, I mean, he'd been, you know, unwell and then better and then unwell again for a while, but New Zealand national treasure Sam Neill passed recently. And given the scope of this particular show, movies that you wouldn't necessarily recommend to people, there seemed only one Sam Neill movie to talk about, and that is Possession from 1981. And you were both quite enthusiastic about talking about that.
Yeah, so we do a thing where Errol comes over mine probably every, like, 2 weeks, roughly.
Yeah, about that.
And we do, like, a film double feature where we pick a theme, and both of us try and pick a film to watch for it.
Theme for this one was watching Possession and the Cronenberg movie Possessor.
Yeah.
That was the joke.
Possession, yeah. Errol had never seen it before, and I'd kind of prefaced it with, like, this film is fucked up.
But she wouldn't tell me how exactly. So you can only imagine the things going through my head when I was watching this.
And you went in, like, completely cold to it.
I did, yeah.
I mean, the thing about Possession is that you could tell someone everything that happens in Possession, and I think they would still be kind of going in cold, because so much of it is the intensely weird atmosphere and the like genuinely haunted performances by Sam Neill and Isabel Ajani. Like, you just have to experience them in order to experience the movie. You really can't spoil that for someone.
Yes, it's like you can describe what happens, but you can't. So much of it is in the performance, like you say, and in the cinematography, and it's so surreal the whole time you're watching it. Yeah. Like, from the very first shot, he's doing this whole, like, exorcist thing. He gets out of the car. He's just stood there. He drops his bags. He picks them up again. He drops them again. He picks them up again. Why? And it's so, like, at every given moment, one of the actors is doing something entirely unexpected, or the camera is
just the wild camera movements, like that pan around
when they're in the office room, and the camera is just, like, going wild.
It just circles the room aggressively.
And when it's not circling aggressively, it's like pinned absolutely stock still while people lose their minds in front of it, you know?
Yes.
And the close-ups as well are incredible, because they're not close-ups with a close-up lens.
Yeah, so normally you'd use, like, a fairly long focal length because it's flattering. You have the camera at a distance. The projection of the face is, like, better for a close-up. But these are, like, wide angles, so the camera was, like, right up in their face, and you feel, like, so close to the actor when they're delivering some of these things. And just, like, how unhinged the performance is, and just, like, how, like, makeup is not, like, trying to make them beautiful. It's just, like, you are right in someone's face when they are losing it at you.
I think it says so much that we've already said a lot about this film. You haven't even touched on the plot.
No.
Like, what's the log line of this? Sam Neill's in it.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I mean, the plot is kind of Sam Neill is a spy he leaves his job to return to his family and finds that his wife wants a divorce and is having an affair. And then as he tries to investigate the affair, it becomes rapidly clear that she's not having an affair with a human being.
Yes, that's a good elevator pitch for it.
I have a slightly different summary that I might deliver later, but I think we need to go through things first.
And in terms of, like, I wouldn't recommend this to people, I did actually try to describe it to my mom, and then a while later we were messing around on Netflix trying to pick something to watch, and I picked something and she goes, "It's not the horrible Worm movie, is it?" This is A Christmas Carol.
Well, I mean, you know, speaking in terms of, like, not recommending things, the thought that I remember having when I watched this movie the first time, which was a long time ago, and I kind of echoed it again this time, is this is a movie that I would not want to watch if I were having any major discomfort in my romantic relationship. Like, if I were in a relationship with someone and I felt like it was in any way unstable, I feel like this movie would turn my head all the way inside out.
Yeah, it would. It was bananas to watch.
Like, I was going through an extremely difficult breakup when we watched this.
Yeah, you are.
I mean, in some ways, that's kind of the perfect thing, because you know it's horrible, as opposed to just feeling like it might be bad. And one of the famous things about it is the director made it sort of influenced by a particularly horrible breakup of his.
Yeah, he was going through a divorce with, I think, his second wife?
Yeah, I think so. And there's a point early in the movie where... So Sam Neill and Isabel Ajani have a son whose name is Bob.
Yes. Incredible thing to call your child.
I know.
And he's like a little Michael Caine.
Yeah, he is. He's fully sat there like, "Oi, mister, you me dad."
But there's a bit early in the movie where he sort of vanishes for a while to be emotionally distraught about her breaking up with him. And then when he comes back, Bob's been abandoned for an indeterminate amount of time.
Yeah, just unspecified time.
And 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Specified time.
Been in the hotel room for 3 weeks. That's true. Don't actually know that was the entirety of the bend that he goes on.
On his own.
Yeah, but apparently that specific episode came from the divorce that is sort of part of the DNA of the movie, which awful.
It's such a powerful emotional choice, I think, because I feel like in a lot of modern horror movies, you have these kind of situations where, like, you're supposed to feel, you know, very distressed because there's a kid involved, you know. But the kid always disappears when it's convenient for the characters to be off, you know, investigating the ghost or what have you. And I think one of the things that really hits in Possession is that Bob is such a presence within this movie.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, there's a scene where, is it right before the terrifying electric knife scene where, like, she's in the kitchen and she's just, like, having a normal conversation with their child.
Yeah.
And everything is normal and fine.
And then there's the really uncomfortable meat grinding.
Yeah. And, like, I think it really speaks to the state of mind that the characters are in, that they are always, like, Bob is never the victim of any of this.
No.
Like, Bob is having an all right time, all things considered.
Yeah.
Like, they're playing, like, trucks and ambulances with him. Yeah. Like, she's making him a little sandwich.
Heinrich gave me this boat.
Yeah, Heinrich gives him a boat. And then... the minute he's off screen, they're just immediately just like, anyway, back to the insanity.
Yeah. I think we've done, like, quite a good job of it so far already. But, like, one of the things with this movie that, like, when we were talking about it, I wanted to make sure that we do is the movie kind of buries the lead on the whole supernatural element, which I think is it's safe for me to say that there is a supernatural element to this film. And there are, like, a few scenes which, like, people always talk about and stick to. But there is so much before that. Mm. Which is so important and, like, so harrowing, like in and of itself, and just so interesting in terms of how it's shot and how the acting is, that I really wanted to make sure that we talked about some of that stuff. So I don't know, Errol, if you want to give your perspective on watching it for the first time with me having
Yes. So again, all Liz had told me about this film was that it's really, really fucked up. And she'd asked, you know, she'd said, you might not be able to handle it. You know, let me know if it's too much. And she'd previously said this about Phase 4, which is a movie about ants, as you know. And I'm terrified of insects. So I'm thinking, like, what is in this film that Liz thinks, of all people, is going to shake me so bad that I can't go on?
And Errol is not a squeamish person.
I'm not a squeamish person. So, like, I really thought that Liz had sat me down to watch, like, this horrible divorce drama. And I'm sat there like, well, you know, my parents are divorced, but I don't know what Liz thinks happened there.
Well, I mean, presumably, like, no one attempting to saw off their own head midway through an argument or anything like that.
Yeah, not that I know of. I got a sailboat now.
Uncle Heinrich.
No, so yeah, nothing like that was going on. And I'm like, this is really visceral. This is like relationship trauma. And like, I've had bad relationships in the past, and I was thinking, like, okay, so probably this is going to escalate to an abuse situation, and it does. And that's like, what, like not even a third of the way through? So I'm sat there thinking, like, how is this going to get horrendous. Like, I'm just sat there, like, experiencing the emotional trajectory of watching Hereditary, like, oh, it's just going to get worse and worse from here. Like, oh no, how much worse could this possibly get? And I was just so viscerally relieved when the detective gets in that apartment and there's a worm. And I'm like, oh, there's a worm. There's a horrible worm. Oh, thank goodness. It's not that bad.
I want to return to a thing, which was, we were talking kind of earlier about how Bob's sort of at the center of things. And that's absolutely right. Like, one of the things that strikes me is how much time Sam Neill spends making sure that Bob is looked after before he goes off and does spy or adventuring stuff.
But yeah, like, he has, I love when a character has obligations and the obligations are present throughout and they don't just disappear when it's convenient.
Yeah,
absolutely. But the other thing is, I mean, Sam Neill is off for the entire movie. He is not a correctly functioning human person.
Oh, no.
But no, he's not.
You don't necessarily notice that as intensely because Isabella Gianni is so wild.
Yes.
And a lot of the stuff that she does, I thought was interesting, is like attempting to do kind of caretaking work for Bob and then it's spiraling out of control.
Yeah.
The image,
like when she comes home and she's just shoving the clothes in the fridge and Sam Neill is like, I can help with that.
Is it, that's a normal thing? Is it normal?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, exactly.
Grinding the meat.
When she's grinding the meat and she's...
That's so harrowing.
She's just grinding it and grinding it and then...
It just feels like she's going to put her hand into the grinder.
Yes. Yeah. And then like a full, what is it, like 3 or 4 scenes later, so like weeks have passed in timeline and Bob's teacher Helen is there. And she's finally cleaned up the pile of mints
that's just been left on the counter.
And we don't know
time.
How long that was there. No. Like, her reaction to it is just like, oh, I've done some cleaning up. And you're like,
have you?
Oh, Helen. Like, run, girl.
Well, absolutely. Like, that was aside from the sort of big reveal at the end, the image that was stuck in my head from this movie from the time I watched it years ago. Was her sort of like desperately but ultimately kind of purposelessly grinding meat while having this like feral argument.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's so, why is she doing this? There's no point to her doing this. She leaves immediately afterwards. And it's, yeah, like Liz was saying, the entire time she's doing that, you think she's going stick her hand in there. Like, it's such a hand.
When she's using the electric like carving knife as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the whole time she's using her hands, you're seeing her move her arms to use her hand.
Like violently.
Yeah. Like, and it's where the shot ends that's really frightening because it ends literally at her wrist.
Mm.
And you can just see her like moving her hand into something. and you just expect that at any minute it's going to pan down and she's just not going to have one of those.
Yeah. It's like that scene where Sam Neill's Mark is flipping the light on and off while he's having that phone conversation. And like the horror movie nerd in you has programmed you into like something in the shot is going to change. Something's going to appear. But no, he's just flipping a light switch on and off. Yeah. But it's tense.
And all of these scenes are so idle in a sense.
Yeah.
I feel as though you'd expect them to be the focal point of the scene. But they're absolutely not. They're just incidentally happening in the background. Yeah. Like, you really feel as though she could chop her whole hand off and they would just keep
carrying.
Yeah.
I mean, with the light switch flipping, there's another scene where it's another one where they're just kind of having an awful tense relationship conversation. But Sam Neill is rocking on a rocking chair like no human being would ever do. And the
focus is changing.
That's right.
On the second watch, yeah. We spotted that. They're literally shifting focus between like him in the foreground when he comes up and then her face when he goes back down. It's like such a quick, repetitive, like focused pull.
It's incredibly technically skilled.
Yeah, and it conveys this just awful kind of futile desperation, I guess. Like, they're both stuck in this position where they feel like they have to do something, but they've got no idea what, so they literally just do whatever's to hand.
Yeah.
Can I ask, Errol, you had, like, a bit of perspective on, like, Isabella Gianni's acting just in terms of, like, gender roles in films?
Yeah, so what really, really struck me about this the first time I watched it with Liz was I just kept saying, like, I've never seen a woman act like this. And I meant that I'd never seen an actress act like this and just be allowed to have such a visceral performance on screen. I mean, we have Shelley Duvall in The Shining, we have Toni Collette in Hereditary, and we hold these up as kind of like the big horror performances, and neither of them really hold a candle to Isabella Gianni in this film, because she's being allowed to do something so viscerally horrible. You know, it's not like she's not like acting within the acceptable spectrum that women are allowed to be seen doing.
No, and she's so, and yeah. She's sort of implacable in it, right? Like she's
yes.
It's not clear at the start of the movie what course she's on, but it's clear that she absolutely can't be steered off it. And a lot of the early part of the movie is Sam Neill kind of banging his head against a wall, trying to convince her of literally anything.
Yes. And she's literally like completely losing her mind. Like even before the famous scene in the U-Bahn, she's the way she acts, like the scene where they slap each other and she's having a complete meltdown is so like you never see people acting like that ever.
One thing I did look into, which I don't know, like I'd need to do more research on this to know like how legitimate it is, but one thing I did look into just sort of briefly after we watched the film last night was I read that in a certain kind of, I don't know what kind it is, but like in a certain kind of Polish theatre, there is like a tendency for this like whole body acting and this like very expressive, exaggerated way of doing that. And some of that was utilized in this film.
That's interesting.
Which is interesting, but yeah, I'd have to look more into that.
I'd like to know more about it.
That's an interesting observation, because certainly I felt on this rewatch that in some ways it is quite a theatrical film. Like,
yeah,
people sort of deliver speeches at one another sometimes.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a way
the way Sam Neill is talking, like the cadence is so bizarre. Yeah. Like he's emphasizing all of the wrong words in every single sentence.
Yeah, like all of the stressed and unstressed syllables are like not what they should be. There's a very odd cadence that you mentioned. It was almost like he was speaking the cadence of German, but without doing a German accent.
Without doing a German accent, which is just fascinating to hear, because it's almost like it's being translated before it hits your ears. And it again, contributes so much to the surreality of every scene he's in.
It's just a very odd delivery to a lot of lines, yeah.
And I mean, it's striking because one of the things that you would ordinarily say about Sam Neill in other movies that he's in, you know, with some exceptions, but often he's quite an understated actor. You know, he's someone who will put a lot into quite a lot of kind of tiny nuance. So hearing him make such a strange choice is really striking.
It's really, really fascinating. And just if we go back to what I was saying about kind of gender roles, the way he reacts to what he sees in this movie is very like female coded. Like he's just sort of stood there looking helplessly at the camera. Like there's that scene where he just stares at the camera every time they cut back to him, right? His reactions are so small and so like micro expression-y. And that compared to Isabella Gianni, like we're used to seeing these kind of big emotions from men on screen. And we're used to seeing women kind of sit there and react and look pretty and like never get too visceral with it, too real. And this film entirely reverses that dynamic, and I really like it.
Absolutely. And there is some capital G gender going on there as well. Because Mark remarks, and it's weirdly kind of offhand to this character, Helen, who is Bob's teacher and is also Isabella Gianni, just to make really confusing. Oh. But he,
bright green eyes.
He remarks to her something like, "Women are awful. They just undermine all of your plans," or something. I can't remember the precise wording, but it's like this sudden outburst of very like stereotypical misogyny, but it's also just kind of absorbed and kind of hopeless.
Yeah. And her character is almost like a projection of like what he maybe wants his wife to be or something. Like she's very much like, "Yes, Mark, that's right."
She's just like, yes, women are awful. Anyway.
And then she sleeps with him and goes, "I hope I haven't proved you right."
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's just such a bizarre.
It's so bizarre.
Like, who is Helen, actually?
She has that line about, like, where I'm from, like, evil is, like, embodied. It's a physical thing. And it's like, is this because, like, she is from... Because this film is fucking set in West Berlin. Like, there's like the Berlin Wall is right there. This is like a little island of the West surrounded by the East. Is it implying like she's from East Germany? Like it's a spectre of communism thing because the director had to flee from like Poland because of the authorities and stuff. By the way, this is in the Cold War. The Berlin Wall is like just ominously in the back of so many shots.
So is she from like some kind of like metaphysical space?
Yeah, or is she just from East Germany? Yeah.
One of the things, and I think this is something that the director said in an interview, was that on some level, the disintegration of the marriage is also, it's him talking about the disintegration of his own marriage, but it's also about him talking about the disintegration of his relationship with Poland and the sort of disintegration of all of the cities that he sees around him that are sort of marred by the Cold War.
Yeah.
I think this is an interesting direction that we're going in because I do think that one of the things that this movie invites because of how odd it is to not take it completely literally. It invites you to do readings like, is Helen kind of the same person as Anna? That's his wife.
Yeah, or is it actually just like a completely different woman and he's projected this image of his wife onto her? It's like, does she actually look like that, or is it, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
And is she even real? Yeah.
Similarly with the supernatural stuff, which we can get to in a bit, is that literally happening, or is that something where he's kind of created an entity in his own head as a way of dealing with the monstrosity of a relationship collapsing, or putting all of the evil in the relationship onto some sort of abstract thing instead of owning it, or however you want to read that.
I guess that is one way of reading it. I mean, you see other characters also see the supernatural entity and react to it, but it's so...
We need to talk about Heinrich at some point, but we'll come
need
back
to talk
that.
About Heinrich for sure. Heinrich is himself a supernatural entity, I feel.
Yeah. Yes. Heinrich 1,000 years. In fact, let us do that in just a second, but we are more or less at the halfway point, so we do need to take a brief break for station messages. We will be back right after this.
If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app.
You are listening to Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū, and you're listening to Reserved Recommendations. This is a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. This evening I am talking to Elizabeth and Errol about the movie Possession from 1981. We need to talk about Heinrich, because Heinrich is spectacularly strange.
Oh my God.
So unusual.
Like, again, you've had this whole kind of like really intense build up, this whole like relationship collapse, this difficult divorce, and we know that Heinrich is this like person that she's been seeing, but we haven't seen Heinrich at this point. And then that first time when we're introduced, when he bursts into Heinrich's apartment, and he's being like the big man, he's like very aggressive, and he's right in Heinrich's face, and he's kind of walking around all over the place, and Heinrich is just like completely unthreatened.
Yeah, entirely. And like just the
date, like touches him, strokes him.
Yes, just starts feeling him up. It's like, oh my God. Like he's not, I was saying to Liz, it's not like Heinrich is sexually threatening. He's just entirely comfortable in a way that he absolutely should not be in this scenario.
No. Right?
And that almost immediately you find out why. Like it's that he can just like kick Sam Neill's ass.
Yeah, he basically beats the shit out of him with yoga moves.
Yeah. And then he's like JoJo posing.
Pop. Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating because he's sort of like, he almost feels like he belongs in a different movie. Part of that is, I think, that he is designed to be the polar opposite of Sam Neill's Mark. Like, he's completely accepting of whatever Anna wants. He is supremely comfortable in his own gender and sexuality. So he can just
very comfortable
fondle Mark and be half naked. And it's not really gay so much as it that doesn't bother him in the slightest.
No.
And
he beats into a bloody pulp and then like cradles him like a baby.
Yeah. And it's like the way that's, because Sam Neill is taller than Heinz Bennett, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can see later when they have the confrontation on the stairs, like, Sam Neill clearly
looks huge,
quite
in
a
that
bit
scene.
Taller.
Yeah, the way it's shot.
But the way, I don't know how they did it. It's some Lord of the Rings, like, standing on a footstool thing.
Sam Neill looks tiny, doesn't he?
He looks like, teeny tiny. He looks almost childlike. He's so fragile.
It's a kid getting, like, thrown around.
Yeah.
Like, by an adult, yeah.
And, like, the adult clearly feels bad about doing it because it's so easy.
Yeah.
And he's just, like, gently picking him up and, like, taking him out.
And like, Sam Neill tries to strangle him. And he's like, no, no, no.
He's like, no, we don't strangle. His mum walks in midway through. Yeah. And she's just, like, a little old lady with a Zimmer frame.
And Sam Neill is, just, like, a professional dog assassin.
Right. And she's just like, hello, dear, don't mind me. And they're like, no worries, mum, I'm just beating Sam Neill up.
Who is a spy? Like,
who
an
is
agent.
A spy, by the way? Yeah. I think one of the things this film does, it's got like this internal logic of power and emotion, and it's the emotionality that makes characters weak and fragile, and almost stoicism that makes them strong, and that's reflected physically. Like later we just see Sam Neill absolutely kick Heinrich's ass, right? And it's because Sam Neill has regained control of his emotions and Heinrich has lost it. And when we see, you know, when the Detective Two. Zimmerman's the first one, and then there's other detective.
Yeah.
Who's his, I guess they're both Zimmerman. They're married.
Oh, true, yeah. Yeah, the pair of gay detectives who are in this movie. Yeah.
That
very, very the lead on that one.
That prompted this is woke for 1981 from my wife when we were watching
it. Really did.
Yeah.
Like, he's just, like, when Detective Two comes in the apartment and he sees his partner's corpse, he's just entirely powerless. And, like, Isabella Gianni hits him with, what is it, like a towel or a tea towel?
She beats him with, like, it's milk. It's a milk carton.
But the first hit is just from like a rag or something. Towel, and the sound effect is...
like she clubbed him.
It's like she clubbed him. And it's just a little piece of cloth. And he goes down as though she's hit him with like an enormous baseball bat.
Yeah, and then she beats him down with a carton of milk.
Right. And it's so... It's the emotionality of it that has done that to him and made him vulnerable. And it's such an interesting visual language, I think.
It's a really good insight because I'd kind of instinctively felt that, but I hadn't really put it into words. And you're exactly right. It's the movie operates on this sort of emotional logic where the person who is, if not like in control, at least has kind of accepted the situation is the person who has the power. And
absolutely.
It operates almost like if you were to like draw a dot to a completely unrelated work, but it operates almost like all those bits in The Lord of the Rings where like characters kind of assume power and then appear like a head taller than everybody else.
Yes.
It's just like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And similarly, like at the point at which Sam Neill has these later confrontations with Heinrich, that's when Heinrich's finally lost control of himself. Like that,
he fully has.
the thing that makes him like physically frail is that he's become desperate.
Like when he shows up on the stairs, he's like an entirely different person to this man who
he's throwing himself all over the place.
He's throwing himself against every wall he's got. Like his hands are constantly up above the like that. His hands are constantly in frame, like wiggling around. Like he's
upwards perspective of Sam Neill at the top of the stairs, where it looks like his head is like almost brushing against the ceiling. Like he looks so tall in that shot.
And Heinrich is. Yeah, I mean, like physically, he's much lower down than somebody like on the stairs. But even when they're back at what should be the same height,
he feels so much smaller suddenly.
He's so much smaller.
So I do want to talk a bit about the way that the movie ends, specifically with the regard to the Cold War, because the Cold War is sort of in the background. But it bookends the movie. The first thing that happens is that Sam Neill is interrogated at length in this very, like, machine gun rapid fire way. And then his spy masters basically vanish for the rest of the movie until everything happens at once at the end.
Yes.
And you'd forgotten all about this, right?
Yeah. Because so much had happened in the meantime.
Yeah. Definitely for me watching it the first time, I had like no instinct that Sam Neill had been a spy because that whole scene where they're telling you that that's his job, essentially, like the camera's just going wild. You can't pay any attention to the dialogue.
Do we need to talk about the worm and the U-bound scene before?
Ah, yes. Perhaps we should
probably talk about the most iconic scene. Yeah.
So maybe we talk about the U-bound first, because I think that's one of the most insane pieces of physical acting I've ever seen.
I can't think of anything that even remotely compares.
And it's interesting. I went and looked at the Wikipedia article for this movie because I wanted to be able to branch off a bunch of stuff that I could have in tabs and look at various things at once. And there are a couple of things in the Wikipedia article in the plot summary where it interprets things in really specific ways, which I didn't necessarily read. And one of those is...
That's interesting.
Is that Anna is having a miscarriage in the course of this sequence.
It's so funny you say that, because we had the same talk literally when we watched it last night.
Because it's commonly kind of like referred to sometimes as like the miscarriage scene. And we don't get that.
That's clearly not what's happening. Like
she's bleeding from her ears.
Coming out of her ears.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's much more like, like the titular possession is entering its final phase. And she is...
I wondered if it was even supposed to be the scene where, like, she perhaps, like, births the worm.
Yeah, potentially. Potentially, because it's, like, bringing something that is not human and incorrect into the world. Yeah, that's absolutely a reading of it. But to describe it for people who haven't seen it, she is walking through like, it's like a pedestrian subway, the U-Bahn. Like you just walk underground, right?
Yes, yeah.
Carrying shopping, because all of the points at which she loses her shit in this movie are all tied to, like, domesticity somehow.
Berlin, which is the capital of Germany, which is an incredibly busy metropolitan place. Oh, this place should be crowded with people.
And it's the middle of the day, and it's a completely empty subway station.
Empty, completely empty.
You see one guy in the ticket office, and that's it, which is... I don't know if you've ever been to Berlin, but this is unthinkable to me.
I mean, I haven't, but one of the things that's striking about the rest of the movie is, like, how weirdly empty the city is a lot of the time.
Even
not having been there, you look at all of the buildings and how big they are and go, this is insane. Like, there's
Where are the people?
Yeah, but it's almost like an interpretive dance, almost. She goes into this kind of whirling half dance, half seizure experience performance. And as I said, it's truly unlike any piece of physical acting I've seen anyone do.
Yes. She's almost like having a panic attack, and it's so viscerally realized.
Yeah, it's such like a visceral panic attack.
It's so... like, it's unrealistic, but it's also horribly realistic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's like the emotional logic in the rest of the film in a lot of ways. Like, the characters behave in these very odd, stagey, unnatural ways, but what they're conveying is a very... it's like an emotionally true thing, even if it's not logically true.
Yes. Without getting into it, I have panic attacks myself. And
I do as well.
And when I first saw this scene, I recognized immediately that that's what she was experiencing, was this, like, total loss of bodily control. Like, that is what it's like to have a panic attack. And to see that realized on screen was really... because, again, like, you don't ever see people act like this in cinema.
No.
Because it's too much. It's too much to ask someone to do, even. And I think if I recall, like, I do remember reading that Ajani's reaction to seeing this scene in the cinema was also very visceral. Like, if I remember correctly, like, she attempted suicide after seeing herself do that. And I think that's because it's such a raw, ugly emotion, and it is so fully realized. And it's difficult to watch.
It's just so visceral.
Yeah, I mean, both Isabella Gianni and Sam Neill have said essentially the same thing, which is that they think it's a very powerful movie, but that they don't think that they could ever do anything like that ever again. Thank you very much.
No.
Yeah.
And yeah, absolutely. It's just an astounding performance from her.
Because obviously the actual, like, catharsis of the moment is so strong and so frightening. I think actually the more disturbing scene is the one immediately before it, when she's in the church and she's looking up at the crucifixion and she's just entirely powerless.
Like, something happens.
Something happens. You have no context for what is happening. She's just staring upwards and she's making these almost like pathetic, sad little noises. And that is really...
and then she's just, like, power walking out.
Yeah, and then she's just leaving. It's fine. Which is... it's so... ooh.
And that's the thing that sort of informed my feeling that pair of scenes is sort of the... like, the trap shutting, if you like, with regards to the possession. Like, she's having this experience of involuntary surrender to whatever the process is that she's going through. And it's not clear what that is exactly, but it's like...
And I appreciate that it is left unclear, because I think that would ruin it.
Yes, yeah. There's no real catalyst for this happening. There's no explanation for it happening.
It just happens.
She has a line early on in the film where Samuel is trying to understand, you know, what's going on with this quote-unquote affair I think you're having. And she says something like, you know, I didn't want it to happen. It just happened. Now there's nothing I can do about it. And that is exactly how it is. In many ways, she has been possessed, like, metaphorically and quite literally.
Yeah, it's perfect, right? Because that's a classic sort of relationship drama line that someone would say when they're just...
It was out of my control, you know. It really, really is.
Yeah. It's so meticulous, weirdly meticulous for a movie this wild, the way that it completes its own logic.
There's a worm in this movie.
There is a worm in this movie. It is a horrible worm.
So good.
The reveal is just like, oh, that's just there.
That's right. That's right. Because for the longest time, all of the discomfort in this movie has been from like the weird empty city and Sam Neill and Isabella Gianni just making each other miserable while acting completely deranged. And trying to parent a kid competently at the same time, which is really stressful to watch.
It's just so stressful.
And then suddenly there is, like, in the immortal words of internet critic Thoughtslime, a really wet puppet just there.
So wet
and horrible. Just like the inclusion of like the fatty liquid within the pool of blood at the foot of the bed is so awful to look at.
Yeah,
it's just, oh.
It's so like, yeah, it doesn't look
really,
like,
really
yeah, like it doesn't look like prop blood. Like it looks like it's a realistic kind of like mix of, yeah, like fatty and just like.
It looks like somebody has melted.
Like some green to it. Like, it's so wet.
It's really unpleasant to look at all of the time.
Exceptionally.
It's really bad to look at.
And that first shot of it is like kind of, you're looking at it from quite a distance.
Oh my God,
like that wide angle.
And you
like,
think for a second it might be.
Oh, it's the dead body.
It's the dead body of the detective. She's done something to it. It's dismembered.
And then you see it writhe and you can see, you can pick out tentacles.
And you, again, it's in kind of a Hereditary moment. It's like that scene where she's crawling across the ceiling, right? Because you very, very slowly realize
what you're looking at.
Something is wrong.
Yeah.
And then you realize what is wrong. And then all you can do is look at it. Oh, it's such an emotional journey.
And it's just there on the bed, just writhing.
Yeah. And then you realize it's on a bed and you're like, no, 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 no.
The indication of what's been happening, which is then obviously made very obvious later.
Yeah. And I think, like, the way that they make it evolve over the course of the film, because, like, it's leading to a very specific conclusion, which, like everything else in this movie, you could read straightforwardly or kind of metaphorically if you want. You get the sort of hints of it, and then, as you say, you get the, like, almost just puddle of slime with tentacles, and then the much more solid version of it that that comes in the kind of notorious wet puppet sex scene. Like, the way that they evolve it over the course of the movie is quite impressive.
Which happens in Margie's house.
Yeah, which happens in Margie's house. We figured we were watching, like, where is this? Where is this place? It's Margie's house.
That's right, because there is another character who, up to this point, we haven't mentioned.
Oh my God, yeah, we haven't talked about.
She has a leg cast.
Yeah.
Yes. I adore her.
Her
it's
name?
Like, I loathe you.
Well, I loathe you.
That's
iconic.
Fascinating, right? Because, like, her and Sam Neill have this insane, incredibly antagonistic relationship, and yet they sort of cooperate in a way that doesn't feel like it should be possible. And so
it's once again very reminiscent of these kinds of relationship dynamics you get when the adults in the room are trying to be adult on behalf of the children, except it's again like taken to this kind of logical extreme where they really, really hate each other.
Yeah,
but at the same time Margie's like, and I'm coming over to babysit.
Yeah, and they hate each other to the point where it's almost like transcended hate and become this sort of like mutual performance that they do for one another's benefit.
Mm.
Yes, it's so, ooh. Like, what is going on with you two? Like, have they had an affair? Is that what's going on? It's just the way they interact with each other in that first scene.
Yeah.
The way they just like walk towards each other from opposite ends of a garden.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's like an insane way to meet someone.
No, you're right, though. Like, there is something heightened about the chemistry that they have as characters that makes the relationship feel like there's an extra layer of strangeness.
Yeah.
And like a lot else in this movie, it doesn't unpack it or explain it. It just makes it weird and uncomfortable, and you have to sit with it.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, you just have to accept that this is what's going on, and we'll put that to one side for now.
But then also, like, you've had this whole thing at this point in the film with, like, oh, the worm. And like you mentioned, the reveal of the worm is almost like relief.
It's
at this
such
point,
relief to find that, like, there's a worm.
Oh, there's a supernatural, like, there's something. Oh, okay, it's that kind of film. Okay.
It's kind of Sam Neill's emotional trajectory.
Yeah.
Right? I keep calling him Sam Neill. His name is Mark in the film, but he's Sam Neill to me.
Because he comes to, like, basically accept what's
like
happening.
He's sat there in the apartment.
He becomes
like,
complicit.
Oh my God, my wife is a murderer.
Yeah.
And then you see him go through this emotional process of, like, she's not cheating on
me. No.
She's been killing people. Yeah. Oh, thank God.
I was going to talk about something else now, but we have to talk about Heinrich's murder.
Oh my God, yes.
This guy is a spy. He has this recurring dream about, like, a dying dog on the porch, which we need to get back to.
The dog's name is Louie.
Louie the dog, which I didn't pick up on this at all the first time I watched it. He recites this, like, three times in
the
film.
He's really trying to monologue
Like, he's
about
trying
it.
To do, like, his Rutger Hauer, like, the obscene things you people wouldn't believe speech, but with this dog, and people keep interrupting or stopping him. He's this spy. He's, I don't know, like a professional dog assassin or something. He has PTSD from killing this dog, I don't know. But he fully, like, Jason Bourne's Heinrich.
He fully does.
And he murders him
in such a convoluted fashion.
Such a convoluted way.
Well, it's...
Like,
it's,
he could have just done that.
It's the way that a spy would do a murder, though, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
He does this convoluted plot where he makes himself vomit with a vile feather from the garbage.
Yeah.
Oh,
unlocks a toilet with a shoe and then fills it with water.
And then
knocks him out instead of drowning him.
But then drowns him anyway.
And then drowns him anyway.
Yeah.
All while there is another man in the cubicle next to them.
There's another guy in there, right next to them.
Like, right, they were previously alone in this bathroom. Like, he could have just done
another
it
guy
then.
Randomly comes in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he climbs over the cubicle to get back out.
And there's no point to doing that except to make the murder read in a way that's confusing enough to throw people off the scent.
Oh my God, I just remembered as well. Heinrich's mother has this thing about, like, or like the body wasn't identified. And then he asked her, like, oh, did you identify it? And she was like, no, the body was there, but the soul had gone.
Yes, what's that?
But supposedly, like, nobody identified. This is Heinrich. So what does that mean?
What did you do, Sam Neill?
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's you have to live in this little old lady's emotional universe for a second, where her entire life has been...
Her son is gone, yeah.
She's been aware of, accepting of, kind of happy about in a sort of vicarious way, the affair that Heinrich's been having with Anna. She's been like, oh, this woman who's cheating on her husband with my son, she's really cool.
Lovely.
I like her.
Her son who has a wife and child in Cincinnati.
Yeah. And the husband seems fine too. He gets along well with Heinrich. I've seen them play together.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's got this logic where she's just made her son's happiness the center of everything somehow.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's such a strange, like, as you say, we're inhabiting this little old lady's emotional universe, and the point at which the film tells us, okay, right, we've been in Sam Neill and Isabella and Danny's world for a while now. Now we're in Heinrich's mom's land.
Yeah. And then the genre of the film changes.
Oh my God, it does. Like, it's the ending of this film is so bananas, in part because it goes from, okay, we're doing horror, now we're doing like thriller, now we're doing like very sad, emotional little old lady killing herself because she's lost her son.
And then the guy in the pink socks appears on the bridge.
Yes, and the
music starts.
And like suddenly there's techno music playing and it's a spy thriller. And it's insane way
There's a chase scene, there's a shootout.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the bit that I wanted to get to, because it's this sudden, it's almost like what Mark and Anna have been going through is this distortion of reality and suddenly reality is crashing back in on them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, did you forget that among all this one business, you also had like a job. The job was being a double agent?
And like, it's like the enemy was like the guy in the pink socks who has now appeared. And
yeah.
Says oh God, what is the line? I can't remember what the line is. It's something about like killing dogs, and then like they're just like metaphorical.
So they're on the bridge. They're on the bridge, and Pink Socks guy says something like, "That dog didn't die of old age, you know."
Yes, that's it.
Like you could spend your time killing dogs, or you could spend your time saving the world.
That's it. That's the line.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like Samuel's finally getting his dog's metaphor.
Yeah. So my belated summary of this film is it's a film about a professional dog assassin whose wife has an affair with God.
Yes, possibly. Because the very final moments after both Mark and Anna die in a literal hail of gunfire, the apocalypse, brackets, question mark.
Yes.
Because the final moments are the worm having metamorphosed into Sam Neill and displaying mind control powers. Because he like knocks on some woman's door and then gives her a job to do that she just does unquestioningly.
And, and this whole like shootout that happens at the end is in this like most incredible vertical spiral staircase space.
You can tell they really enjoyed filming in that building.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a completely crazy space, and all of the shooting happens completely vertically. Like,
yeah.
Yes.
The Sam Neill is shooting down at, I think, the cops and spies who are shooting up at him and Anna from below. But after they both get killed, or I think she kills herself,
She's laying on top of him. She takes his gun and she contorts herself.
Yeah, she contorts herself all the way backwards to shoot herself in the spine.
Spine, yeah.
Which is bananas.
Yeah, again.
And also, like, what a move.
An incredibly visually striking way to kill yourself that is incredibly stagey and doesn't really make sense.
She did it for the aesthetic, you know. I admire that.
As the final moments unfold, what we get in the background is like war sound effects .wav getting louder and louder and louder and louder.
Maybe they sound a lot like cats.
Yeah, the cat missiles.
Yeah.
But the cats are like, the missiles are like, meow, meow, meow. It's like no war sound effect I've ever heard.
That's what it's supposed
to be.
Like bombs and missiles. Yeah.
And so the implication is, I suppose, that the worm finally reaching its final form is the thing that ends the world?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Brings about the end of the world.
Yeah.
And Bob's reaction.
And Bob's reaction is so... It reminds me a lot of the end of Time Bandits, where the kid is like, no, Mom, Dad, it's evil. That's kind of what he's saying.
What does Bob say?
He says, don't open it. And then he goes and drowns himself.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly bleak ending.
It really is. Like, every single person these two people have come in contact with has died horribly.
Yeah.
And it finishes on Helen, Bob's school teacher, who is, as we said, also Isabella Gianni, just kind of staring into the camera with these incredible luminous green eyes.
Yeah, yes. Worm Samuel is kind of smearing himself against.
Contorting, he's not even
Like the frosted window, and he's just like smearing up against it.
Like he's not knocking on the door.
No.
He's trying to get in as though he's going to phase through it.
Yeah.
Which, again, like it really calls into question what Helen is supposed to be?
Yes. Like, is she... Because I think it's not a coincidence that she has the same color palette as Worm Sam Neill. Like, Sam Neill, he's got these luminous green eyes. Pretty visceral green eyes. And, like, their hair color is slightly lighter.
But what does it mean?
Like, did Isabelle Adjani grow Helen first? She talks a lot about, you know, she's got sister's faith and sister's chance inside of her, and sister faith has wandered off. Incredible word salad monologue, by the way. The way she delivers that is so... You're trying to follow it.
You can't...
The way she keeps repeating herself, it's like she's forgotten her lines, but it feels so much like she's just making it up as she goes along.
Yeah.
But is that what this is? Are these the good parts of the characters? Because how can we possibly believe that, given the situation? Yeah. Are they the bad parts of the characters? Well, does that imply that what we've seen is the good Why did this happen? We have no idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, it is confounding, but it will also, I will comfortably predict, live in the head of anybody who watches it basically forever.
Oh my God, yes, it will.
Because it's just such...
It's my description of it. It sounded insane to anyone who's never seen this movie before. Yeah. You need to actually watch it.
Like, listeners, if you haven't seen this, the way we've described this movie happening to you is exactly how it happens.
Yeah, like... and I stand by my assertion that you can listen to all of this and read a plot summary somewhere and a review and whatever you want, and it is...
You still won't be ready for it.
Yeah, it's impossible to spoil yourself for the experience of actually watching these people do these very strange things.
Yes. I think after we finished watching it the first time,
I remember roughly what you said.
I was just sat there in dead silence for a while, and then I just quietly said to Liz, but also to myself, like, I don't think I need to watch another movie ever again.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen them. Everything that could possibly have happened has happened in this film.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for at least in part, like, justifying my feelings about this movie, because
you're welcome.
This is the Possession Watchers support group.
Good movie. What a good movie.
What a film.
Fucking cinema, man. It's incredible. Yeah. I like to finish by asking a couple of different questions. One of them is, what would you double feature this movie with? Now, you said like the pun answer, possession, possessor, but like...
Yeah.
Yes.
Emotionally, do you have like a shot chaser or a, I really want to turn someone's head all the way inside out combination?
So my initial thinking was to pair it with the adaptation of the book Possession, which is a romance, which would just be a delightful counterpoint. And also, and again, very funny pun wise. I can't really think of anything that holds up to it.
No, like there are films which might have like similar elements
like Black Swan for the kind, again, like this kind of very visceral, like female focused, like,
yeah, something that Raised Me Baby experience. Or something. Yeah, but it's like, it's,
but I don't think I'd pair it with anything.
Comparable. No.
Yeah.
No. And I have a pitch for horribly bleak ending after a lot of people have fairly deranged performances, which would be to watch Ran by Akira Kurosawa. That's his adaptation of King Lear. And it finishes with the blind character feeling his way towards the edge of a cliff over and over again, ?
Oh my God, that is bleak.
It's really bleak.
That is the experience of watching Possession, though.
Yeah. Kind of. The other things...
And then the cliff is the spy movie.
The other things I might suggest would be Dogtooth by Yorgos Lanthimos.
I've not seen that one. Might have to be on the list.
Dogtooth is great. It's very different. It's more about, I guess, child abuse as a metaphor for fascism?
Okay.
It's about like a man and his wife who are controlling their children's world to the point of teaching them the wrong definitions for common words.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very strange.
That's dark. And yeah, like in many ways, this is like divorce is a metaphor for communism.
Yeah.
So that's a good pairing.
And the final maybe suggestion would be the movie Enemy by Denis Villeneuve, which is about two equally awful Jake Gyllenhaals encountering each other in the yellowest Toronto you have ever seen.
Okay, all right, you've sold me on that. Yeah, yellow Toronto is a delight.
It's incredibly yellow and full of like preposterously large spiders that don't obviously connect to anything else that's happening. They're just sometimes there in the background. Yeah. The final thing I would like to do is give you an opportunity to plug anything that you have to plug. What have you got?
Stuff on the Phase 4 one, so I'm going to give this one to Errol.
My job is a queer historian. I guess
you do editing and you're doing some games.
I can't really plug gay Puritans though.
No.
Go to your local archive, read some stuff. That would be great. No, I guess we could talk about what we're working on. Which is a solo... Is that a solo role playing game if you play with two people?
Like a duet.
Yeah,
it's a duet
kind of journaling game called Ye Mighty and Despair. In Ye Mighty, you will play as the ruler of an ancient kingdom, and in And Despair, you play as the archaeologist digging it up again.
Oh, that's very clever. I like it. I like it entirely sight unseen. That's very cool.
Wait until you see how we're printing it.
Oh. I like messing around with printing and typesetting and stuff as well. Yes, very cool indeed.
Do you want to talk about your Sam Neill multiverse theory before we go?
Maybe.
Yeah, do it. Do it, absolutely.
I kind of have a thing when I'm watching Sam Neill movies that I kind of like imagine that they're all part of the same continuity. So, you know, you have this guy who's maybe had like this really difficult divorce or like this kind of situation. Well, I don't know, maybe this happens afterwards, but you know, at some point he's Dr. Grant and he goes to Jurassic Park. He gets very traumatized by the dinosaurs and the raptors. And then, you know, he thinks, well, I want to flee to like the one place that there definitely won't be any velociraptors, which is outer space.
Not so
you
Berlin.
Have like Event Horizon, not Berlin. Yeah. So you have Event Horizon and that doesn't work out well for him either.
No, and you know, after going through all of those horrible things, he holes up in the New Zealand bush and befriends like a chubby Māori kid and they go on wacky adventures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's growth.
That sounds great. There was a thing that my wife observed about Sam Neill, which is that he sort of grew into his face. Like, by the time you see him in Jurassic Park, he looks kind of distinguished and serious. But in Possession, his very square face on his kind of tall, thin frame kind of looks out of place, and it adds a lot to how strange Mark is as a character.
Especially with, like, the unhinged, like, smiles into camera. And
Oh, my God, yeah. There are moments where he looks almost like a child.
Yes.
Yeah, and, yeah, like, absolutely.
There are moments when they both look like children and are kind of acting like children. Yeah, which I think was like feels like quite a deliberate casting choice because what was that I said? About a boy.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who has a name and is an actor and is very good and memorable. I'm just really bad with names.
Tony from Skins.
Tony's Tyler's, bullshit from the menu.
Yeah, Tyler's Tony? Bullshit.
Tony?
No, Tony from Skins.
Oh, okay.
Tyler's bullshit.
We're so sorry, Tony from Skins, about a boy and Tyler from the menu.
The problem is the actor has a name. He's a good actor. I like him.
But his roles are so iconic.
Yeah, I always refer to him by role.
He looks like Sam Neill in this film. Possession.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o Ngā Tangata o Manawatu. The show was produced and edited by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with a friend? You can find past episodes at npr.nz/show/reserved or wherever fine pods are cast. You can find me on Blue Sky at Objective Reality, and you can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook.